Chapter 16. We'da got another situation, but the agent, he's dead against us. It ain't no fault of ours, neither, but at this point Lily's impatience overcame her. I if you have anything to say to me, she interposed. The woman's resentment of the rebuff seemed to spur her lagging ideas. Yes, miss, I'm coming to that, she said. She paused again, with her eyes on Lily, and then continued, in a tone of diffuse narrative colon when we was at the Benedict I had charge of some of the gentlemen's rooms. Leastways, I swept them out on Saturdays. Some of the gentlemen got the greatest sight of letters. I never saw the like of it. Their waste paper baskets de be fairly brimming, and papers falling over on the floor. Maybe having so many is how they get so careless. Some of them is worse than others. Mr. Selden, Mr. Lawrence Selden, he was always one of the carefulest. Burnt his letters in winter, and tore them in little bits in summer. But sometimes he'd have so many he'd just bunch them together, the way the others did, and tear the lot through once like this. While she spoke as he had loosened the string from the parcel in her hand, and now she drew forth a letter which she laid on the table between Miss Bart and herself. As he had said, the letter was torn in two, but with a rapid gesture she laid the torn edges together and smoothed out the page. A wave of indignation swept over Lily. She felt herself in the presence of something vile, as yet but dimly conjectured the kind of vileness of which people whispered, but which he had never thought of as touching her own life. She drew back with a motion of disgust, but her withdrawal was checked by a sudden discovery. Under the glare of Mrs. Peniston's chandelier, he had recognized the handwriting of the letter. It was a large disjointed hand, with a flourish of masculinity which, but slightly disguised its rambling weakness, and the words, scrawled in heavy ink on pale-tinted NOTEP 108 greater than paper, smote on Lily's ear, as though he had heard them spoken. At first she did not grasp the full import of the situation. She understood only that before her lay a letter written by Bertha Dorset, and addressed, presumably, to Lawrence Selden. There was no date, but the blackness of the ink proved the writing to be comparatively recent. The packet in Mrs. Affin's hand doubtless contained more letters of the same kind, a dozen, Lily conjectured from its thickness. The letter before her was short, but its few words, which had leapt into her brain before she was conscious of reading them, told a long history, a history over which, for the last 4 years, the friends of the writer had smiled and shrugged, viewing it merely as one among the countless good situations of the mundane comedy. Now the other side presented itself to Lily, the volcanic nether side of the surface over which conjecture and innuendo glide so lightly till the first fissure turns their whisper to a shriek. Lily knew that there is nothing society resents so much as having given its protection to those who have not known how to profit by it. It is for having betrayed its connivance that the body social punishes the offender who is found out. And in this case there was no doubt of the issue. The code of Lily's world decreed that a woman's husband should be the only judge of her conduct. She was technically above suspicion, while he had the shelter of his approval, or even of his indifference. But with a man of George Dorset's temper there could be no thought of condemnation. The possessor of his wife's letters could overthrow with a touch the whole structure of her existence. And into what hands Bertha Dorset's secret had been delivered. For a moment the irony of the coincidence tinged Lily's disgust with a confused sense of triumph. But the disgust prevailed all her instinctive resistances, of taste, of training, of blind inherited scruples, rose against the other feeling. Her strongest sense was one of personal contamination. She moved away, as though to put as much distance as possible between herself and her visitor. I know nothing of these letters, she said. I have no idea why you have brought them here. Mrs. Affin faced her steadily. I'll tell you why, miss. I brought them to you to sell, because I ain't got no other way of raising money, and if we don't pay our rent by tomorrow night we'll be put out. I never done anything of the kind before, and if you'd speak to Mr. Selden, or to Mr. Rosedale about getting Affin taken on again at the Benedict, I seen you talking to Mr. Rosedale on the steps. That day you come out of Mr. Selden's rooms, the blood rushed to Lily's forehead. She understood now Mrs. Affin supposed her to be the writer of the letters. In the first leap of her anger she was about to ring and order the woman out. But an obscure impulse restrained her. The mention of Selden's name had started a new train of thought. Bertha Dorset's letters were nothing to her, they might go where the current of chance carried them. But Selden was inextricably involved in their fate. Men do not, at worst, suffer much from such exposure, and in this instance the flash of divination which had carried the meaning of the letters to Lily's brain had revealed also that they were appeals repeated, and therefore probably unanswered for the renewal of a tie which time had evidently relaxed. Nevertheless, the fact that the correspondence had been allowed to fall into strange hands would convict Selden of negligence in a matter where the world holds at least pardonable, and there were graver risks to consider where a man of Dorset's ticklish balance was concerned. If she weighed all these things it was unconsciously. She was aware only of feeling that Selden would wish the letters rescued, and that therefore she must obtain possession of them. Beyond that her mind did not travel. As he had, indeed, a quick vision of returning the packet to Bertha Dorset, and of the opportunities the restitution offered. But this thought lit up abysses from which she shrank back ashamed. Meanwhile Mrs. Affin, prompt to perceive her hesitation, had already opened the packet, and ranged its contents on the table. All the letters had been pieced together with strips of thin paper. Some were in small fragments, the others merely torn in half. Though there were not many, thus spread out they nearly covered the table. Lily's glance fell on a word here and there, then she said in a low voice, "Colin, what do you wish me to pay you?" Mrs. Affin's face reddened with satisfaction. It was clear that the young lady was badly frightened, and Mrs. Affin was the woman to make the most of such fears. Anticipating an easier victory than as he had foreseen, she named an exorbitant sum. But Miss Bart showed herself a less ready prey than might have been expected from her imprudent opening. She refused to pay the price named, and after a moment's hesitation, met it by a counteroffer of half the amount. Mrs. Affin immediately stiffened. Her hand traveled toward the outspread letters, and folding them slowly, she made as though to restore them to their wrapping. "I guess they're worth more to you than to me, miss, but the poor has got to live as well as the rich," she observed sententiously. Lily was throbbing with fear, but the insinuation fortified her resistance. "You are mistaken," she said indifferently. I have offered all I am willing to give for the letters, but there may be other ways of getting them." Mrs. Affin raised a suspicious glance. She was too experienced not to know that the traffic she was engaged in had perils as great as its rewards, and as he had a vision of the elaborate machinery of revenge which a word of this commanding young lady's might set in motion. She applied the corner of her shawl to her eyes, and murmured through it that no good came of bearing too hard on the poor, but that for her part as he had never been mixed up in such a business before, and that on her honor as a Christian all she and Affin had thought of was that the letters mustn't go any farther. Lily stood motionless, keeping between herself and the charwoman the greatest distance compatible with the need of speaking in low tones. The idea of bargaining for the letters was intolerable to her, but she knew that, if she appeared to weaken, Mrs. Affin would at once increase her original demand. She could never afterward recall how long the duel lasted, or what was the decisive stroke which finally, after a lapse of time recorded in minutes by the clock, in hours by the PREP 111 greater than precipitate beat of her pulses, put her in possession of the letters. She knew only that the door had finally closed, and that she stood alone with the packet in her hand. As he had no idea of reading the letters, even to unfold Mrs. Affin's dirty newspaper would have seemed degrading. But what did she intend to do with its contents? the recipient of the letters, had meant to destroy them, and it was her duty to carry out his intention. As he had no right to keep them, to do so was to lessen whatever merit lay in having secured their possession. But how destroy them so effectually that there should be no second risk of their falling in such hands? Mrs. Peniston's icy drawing room grate shone with a forbidding luster. The fire, like the lamps, was never lit except when there was company. Miss Bart was turning to carry the letters upstairs when she heard the opening of the outer door, and her aunt entered the drawing room. Mrs. Peniston was a small, plump woman, with a colorless skin lined with trivial wrinkles. Her gray hair was arranged with precision, and her clothes looked excessively new, and yet slightly old-fashioned. They were always black and tightly fitting, with an expensive glitter. She was the kind of woman who wore jet at breakfast. Lily had never seen her when she was not cuirassed in shining black, with small tight boots, and an air of being packed and ready to start. Yet she never started. She looked about the drawing room with an expression of minute scrutiny. I saw a streak of light under one of the blinds as I drove up. It's extraordinary that I can never teach that woman to draw them down evenly. Having corrected the irregularity, she seated herself on one of the glossy purple armchairs. Mrs. Peniston always sat on the chair, never in it. Then she turned her glance to Miss Bart. My dear, you look tired. I suppose it's the excitement of the wedding. Cornelia Van Alstyne was full of it. Molly was there, and Gertie Farish ran in for a minute to tell us about it. I think it was odd, they're serving melons before the consommé. A wedding breakfast should always begin with consommé. Molly didn't care for the bridesmaids' dresses. As he had it straight from Julia Melson, that they cost $300 apiece at Celeste's, but she says they didn't look it. I'm glad you decided not to be a bridesmaid. That shade of salmon pink wouldn't have suited you. Mrs. Peniston delighted in discussing the minute's details of festivities in which S.E. had not taken part. Nothing would have induced her to undergo the exertion and fatigue of attending the Van Osburgh wedding, but so great was her interest in the event that, having heard two versions of it, she now prepared to extract a third from her niece. Lily, however, had been deplorably careless in noting the particulars of the entertainment. As he had failed to observe the color of Mrs. Van Osburgh's gown, and could not even say whether the old Van Osburgh severs had been used at the bride's table. Mrs. Peniston, in short, found that she was of more service as a listener than as a narrator. Really, Lily, I don't see why you took the trouble to go to the wedding if you don't remember what happened or whom you saw there. When I was a girl, I used to keep the menu of every dinner I went to, and write the names of the people on the back, and I never threw away my cotillion favors till after your uncle's death, when it seemed unsuitable to have so many colored things about the house. I had a whole closet full, I remember, and I can tell to this day what balls I got them at. Molly Van Alstyne reminds me of what I was at that age. It's wonderful how she notices. She was able to tell her mother exactly how the wedding dress was cut, and we knew at once, from the fold in the back, that it must have come from Paquin. Mrs. Peniston rose abruptly, and, advancing to the ormolu clock surmounted by a helmeted Minerva, which throned on the chimney piece between two malachite vases, passed her lace handkerchief between the helmet and its visor. "I knew it, the parlor maid never dusts there," she exclaimed, triumphantly displaying a minute spot on the handkerchief. Then, reseating herself, she went on, "Cole and Molly thought Mrs. Dorset the best dressed woman at the wedding. I've no doubt her dress did cost more than anyone else's, but I can't quite like the idea a combination of sable and point de Milan. It seems she goes to a new man in Paris, who won't take an order till his client has spent a day with him at his villa at Neuilly. He says he must study his subject's home life, a most peculiar arrangement, I should say. But Mrs. Dorset told Molly about it herself. She said the villa was full of the most exquisite things, and she was really sorry to leave. Molly said she never saw her looking better. She was in tremendous spirits, and said as he had made a match between Evie Van Osburgh and Percy Grice. She really seems to have a very good influence on young men. I hear she is interesting herself now in that silly Silverton boy, who has had his head turned by Carrie Fisher, and has been gambling so dreadfully. Well, as I was saying, Evie is really engaged. Mrs. Dorset had her to stay with Percy Grice, and managed it all, and Grace Van Osburgh is in the seventh heaven as he had almost despaired of marrying Evie. Mrs. Peniston again paused, but this time her scrutiny addressed itself, not to the furniture, but to her niece. Cornelia Van Elston was so surprised. As he had heard, that they were to marry young Grice. She saw the Wetherills, just after they had stopped with you at Bellomont, and Alice Wetherill was quite sure there was an engagement. She said that when Mr. Grice left unexpectedly one morning, they all thought he had rushed to town for the ring. Lily rose and moved toward the door. I believe I am tired. I think I will go to bed, she said. And Mrs. Peniston, suddenly distracted by the discovery that the easel sustaining the late Mr. Peniston's crayon portrait was not exactly in line with the sofa in front of it, presented an absent-minded brow to her kiss. In her own room, Lily turned up the gas jet and glanced toward the grate. It was as brilliantly polished as the one below, but here at least she could burn a few papers with less risk of incurring her aunt's disapproval. She made no immediate motion to do so, however, but dropping into a chair looked wearily about her. Her room was large, and comfortably furnished. It was the envy and admiration of poor Grace Stepney, who boarded. But, contrasted with the light tints and luxurious appointments of the guest rooms where so many weeks of Lily's existence were spent, it seemed as dreary as a prison. The monumental wardrobe and bedstead of black walnut had migrated from Mr. Peniston's bedroom, and the magenta lock wallpaper, of a pattern dear to the early 60s, was hung with large steel engravings of an anecdotic character. Lily had tried to mitigate this charmless background by a few frivolous touches, in the shape of a lace-decked toilet table, and a little painted desk surmounted by photographs. But the futility of the attempt struck her as she. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.